Thinking Basketball Podcast. My name is Ben. Welcome back to another episode. I am absolutely stoked about this one. If you're watching on YouTube, we figured out how to get the camera working, but it's a little too intense. I'm like in HD. I feel like I'm on a movie set. And more importantly, the topic today, the thing that I'm really excited about, Cody, we are going to discuss the best heliocentric players in the NBA right now. If you don't know what heliocentrism is, it's a term coined by the Athletic's Seth Partnow to talk about the rise and sort of individual dominance of players doing everything. Typically a guy doing a lot of scoring and a lot of playmaking with teammates spread around him on the court. And the classical construction we've seen LeBron James play this style. We've seen James Harden play this style. Luka Doncic and Trae Young do it today. The classical construction is that you have that spread pick and roll master who can go get his own or make all of the kickout passes and cutter passes and lay down passes to all the shooters on the court. But today, when we say the best heliocentric players, we're really talking about like the guys who are out there as the lone star. That's really what we're talking about. Sort of. So that's our definition we're working with. The guys who are the only real big drivers of offense while they're out on the court. And we're going to try to figure out who's the best at playing that role right now.
And I think what makes it really interesting is you named a couple of guys that, you know, had we done this exercise 10 years ago, it'd be a no-brainer. They'd be like number one, number two, number three, or something like that. But I also like the idea of it. It doesn't necessarily look like it's always looked like. Like, Helio Ball isn't necessarily how you conceived of it, what, 7 years ago, 8 years ago. There's a couple of guys that might be on the list here that don't play like most people who play Helio Ball.
Yeah, I think despite your wounded state, Cody's recovering from some kind of cold and powering through. I think, do you agree with me that the best way to do this and to frame this is to essentially do a list? I don't know. I just like, how else can we do this without kind of walking people through a countdown, even though it also feels very impossible for me to rank players like this because we only really started talking about this construct about 5 days ago.
Yeah, I feel like if it wasn't a list component, it would just be us sitting here listing some guys like, that's a real Helio guy, and be like, yeah, he can pass the ball, he can score the rock. I feel like this like constrains us and makes us like compare and contrast, see the different styles, see like the pros and cons of them, and kind of look at the whole comprehensive idea of what it means to be a Helio guy. So I like the idea of the list.
Okay, yeah. So we're gonna try to do a list. We're gonna try to rank the best Helio players in the sport right now. We're really the guys who are, maybe floor raising. Maybe when they're the only star out there on offense, they give you the most lift. Maybe that's another way to think about it. And I don't know about you, but I had about 13 or 14 names that kind of came up for me. And then after that, I was like, well, you might be pretty good, but I can't probably get you into my top 10 Helio rankings.
Yeah, I think ultimately, like, my first go round had like 30 some players, and I was just tossing, and everyone was getting on the list, Ben. Like, I was like, oh, you're a player on this team, and I haven't looked up anyone here. We might as well see how you are. And it's safe to say that they're not going to be in the conversation, but I do think that there's probably, I don't know, what would you say, like, around nine-ish, 7 to 9 that I was really comfortable with, and I'm like, you know, they should probably be in the top 10 somewhere. But then, like you said, there's a few more after that where I'm like, but they're all a little bit interesting. They might get into the mix. And I think those are going to be some of the guys that are most interesting to me because I think some of them are unproven in the playoffs. We haven't seen a big enough sample size. Some of these other guys, I don't know if they're getting like a they've done it before a couple of years ago sort of thing. So I don't know. That's how I ended up with my list of I don't even know. I have a lot of data sitting in front of me right now, Ben.
I have about 9 guys. Who were some names that maybe surprised you or jumped out to you when you were looking at how these players perform when they're the only primary driver of offense on the court. So for some of them, they're on a team where there aren't many other players who can drive offense. So it's not that different than what we see for their everyday stats. But other guys, it's like they play with one or two other stars, and we're really interested in what happens when those guys go to the bench.
I think the first guy that came to mind where I was like, oh, look at this dude, is Desmond Bane. Because I think he's thought of as a lot more of a play finisher, plays next to Ja Morant, more in like a team sort of structure. But when Ja Morant goes to the bench, Ben, when he's on the bench, it's not a huge sample size. What it's right around 300 or so minutes where Bane is on the court without Ja. He's averaging like 29 points per 75, 61% true shooting. He's throwing, you know, how many assists? Like 6 assists per game. I think that was the thing that really stood out to me, because a few years ago when Bane was really getting on the scene, the creation wasn't quite there. That was the thing that was lacking more than his impressive shooting ability. But now we're seeing the whole package to come together. And in those moments where he needs to shift up and roll, he's proven that at least so far in the season, he's able to do that pretty well.
Yeah, there's a pretty big jump when Bane plays with Ja Morant. And when Ja Morant goes to the bench, in Desmond's playmaking. So in our estimates of shot creation, he creates about 5 shots per 100 when Morant is on the floor. And that jumps to 11 per 100, to your point, when Morant goes to the bench. One thing to note about the small sample is Bane is shooting 49% in those 300-something minutes from downtown. So that will probably... I mean, he is Desmond Bane, but that's probably not going to hold up the old... you know, take 9 threes per 75 attempts and make 50% of them. So there'll probably be some regression there. But it's interesting to see guys who kind of jump out in ways that you wouldn't expect. I know another one that we'll probably not talk about as we count down this list in a second and get to some of the more challenging and philosophical discussions that we always, the waters that we always wade into on this show. But I know another one near and dear to your heart that we probably won't talk about is Jrue Holiday. Like, When Giannis and even when Chris Middleton goes off the court, Holiday kind of does some kind of amazing things in terms of upticking his load and the way he carries that team.
I think what's interesting, this, I didn't really start noticing this about Holiday. I didn't take a huge interest in Holiday until he made it to Milwaukee. You know, I was a lot more critical of the trade when it happened, and then, you know, I realized the error of my ways. But I noticed it after the finals, like trying to figure out what was going on that kind of separated the Bucks from the Suns in 2021. And a big part of it was Jrue Holiday's ability to shift up in his role like that. And I think if you look at it this season, he's a little bit less efficient than he has been the last couple of seasons when he's a lone star out there. The plus-minus numbers for the team look pretty solid. I think there's still a positive when he's on the court without Giannis and Chris, which is interesting because if you go back even a couple more years and include like the last 3 years, it's even better. It's even more of a plus-minus, and Holiday's numbers really skyrocket to the point where you'd be like, really? This dude's averaging this? It's like a 1,000-minute sample, and he's like a 30-10 guy per 75 when you look at those numbers. So I think that is probably the guy that would surprise the most and definitely shocked me a little bit when I dug into the numbers as to at least being mentioned in this conversation.
Okay, unless there's anyone else that you don't think is going to be part of the sort of collection of stars that we talk about for the rest of the show, you know, it's like speak now or forever hold your peace, Cody, because I'm going to start asking you about some of these guys that I was like, yeah, for me, I probably had about 9 players, as you said, that I was pretty comfortable with saying, I think if I have a lone star out there, these are the 9 guys who I'm probably best with, and I think I'm probably or certainly going to get the most production out of, right? Like whichever lens you want to look at it through, there's those guys. And then there's a handful of guys that I'm not really sure what to do with these dudes. Let's start in Boston with Jason Tatum. He's one of these players where it seems like he's kind of already optimized or in a position to kind of modulate his load. That's another term I've used for this before, like modulate his load upward, but he's kind of already maybe at the limits of what he's doing.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think a big thing with Tatum is a couple of years ago, people really started taking note of his, again, kind of like Bane, the improved passing ability, because I think that was the skill set that was lagging a little bit for him. And his team passing has developed immensely. Like, he fits into a team context really well. But that linear progression isn't really linear anymore, right? Like, maybe on the margins he's improving as a passer, but it doesn't seem like he's going to, like, break through to the point where he's creating to the level of some of these other, like, high-level Helio Lone Star kinds of guys. And I think, ultimately, when I think about Tatum, that's probably the thing that mostly holds him back in this.
Like he's really good, but the guys we're going to get to are closer to that one-man offense concept, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Tatum's a lot better at finding his own, but there are some other guys that I'm like, all right, if we spread out the court and put him out here, this guy's going to go out there and be able to get everyone involved, get everyone some more open shots, and that's the area where I'm, with Tatum, a little bit skeptical that he could do this as well as some of these other guys. Not saying Tatum can't do it, but to the degree of, say, the top 10 list, I don't think he's quite there.
So when I say something like optimized or maximized, what I was alluding to is when Jaylen Brown is on the court, Tatum already averages 30 points per 75. And his shot creation estimates don't change that much when Jaylen goes to the bench this season. He's played over 500 minutes without Brown, and he does do a little bit more heavy lifting. He does have the ball a little bit more. He does create a little bit more offense. But you're talking about a guy going from 30 points per 75 on true shooting percentage that's 5 points ahead of the league. So he's 30 plus 5 with Jaylen Brown out there. When Jaylen Brown goes to the bench, he's 31 minus 1 with a little more play. All the symptoms you would see of doing a little bit more. More assists, more playmaking, passer ratings a little higher, takes more threes, gets to the line a little bit more. So that's what I'm referring to when I'm talking about that original role he's playing when Brown is on the court is still probably close to, let's say, Tatum's capacity as a heliocentric guy, as the lone star.
And I think with Tatum, what's really interesting about him is one number might jump out, and that is the offensive rating of the team when Jaylen Brown is on the bench. Because it's still like in the high 120s. Like, it is still one of the best Lone Star offensive ratings in the league. But the thing about the Celtics is that they were able to build a team of ball handlers and passers at pretty much every position, right? The Al Horfords, the Derek Whites, Marcus Smart, all these guys, Malcolm Brogdon, can all get in, get 2 feet in the paint, and move the ball around. And again, Jason Tatum fits really well into that context. But I think in the traditional, you know, what you imagine with the Harden Rockets or the LeBron Cavaliers, I think that's much less suited to Tatum's skill set.
Boy, can we talk about LeBron now?
This is actually one of the more interesting players in this discussion in my mind.
So he's another one of these guys that I'm not sure what to do with. He's in this inner circle of like players we want to talk about beyond just, oh, Drew Holiday's, you know, got more kind of Lone Star power than you might expect. LeBron James, historically at his peak during his prime, traditionally would be one of the kings of this category. He's one of the OG heliocentric one-man offenses. I talked about it in his Greatest Peaks profile, which focused on his 2012 and 2013 seasons in Miami, where it's like he was so good at that role that when Dwayne Wade went out, the Heat didn't lose much because the Heat were just better off having LeBron do all of the driving and all of the captaining of the ship back then. But Cody, this is a different LeBron James. This is LeBron James. He's 48 years old at this point. did I add a decade? Who can tell? The man has been, he and Tom Brady, they've been playing sports since black and white. That's all you need to know. There wasn't color when they started playing sports. LeBron, it's not the same, but it's still pretty good. LeBron James, now I don't know about you. I looked at when Russell Westbrook goes off the court. We could also look at when Anthony Davis goes off the court. But his numbers are kind of similar this year, whether they're on the floor or off the floor.
And I think what's really interesting about LeBron in this conversation is, was this even like last night? Did he just drop 48 points last night? Did I see that? Did 48-year-old LeBron go out there and get like 2 points away from a 50-piece? And, you know, he continues to go out there and throw out these huge stats. And I think you highlighted this in somewhat of a player profile I think it was last year when the Lakers moved him to center, and you're like, look at their effectiveness on offense when he's in center. But it's like, well, yeah, that's because they're completely sacrificing defense and taking advantage of as much spacing as possible. So with LeBron at this point, he's just, his physicality, Ben, is just unreal, off the chart. So he can still get good looks playing at the four or the five. They're sacrificing a ton of defense. So if I'm thinking about it in like a functional championship level, actual lineup that you would want to see, what would he look like next to these other guys? And that's really the question that I keep butting my head up against it, Ben. I genuinely don't know if LeBron was actually surrounded by, like, you know, a classic LeBron spread pick and roll type of team, and they were going for a championship, what would his numbers and team effectiveness look like? And I, compared to like the other top nine guys that I have solidly here, I don't know if he cracks that. I don't know if he hits 10. I'm not 100% sure about him.
I love that your voice cracked on
crack. I did.
That was absolutely spectacular theater. You deliver it for everyone. LeBron, 33 points per 75 this season in just 400 minutes without AD or Westbrook. But I think to your point, Cody, it's similar to last year where, like, if he's playing the four or the five and you're kind of sacrificing a bunch of defense, gimmick is not the right word, but you just probably, that's not the ideal lineup that you would see him in on a more competitive team. And so in my head, it's like, if he's playing that role, he's still very good. There probably aren't many players left in the league who are better. I should add 33 points per 75 in that stretch is just under 60% true shooting. So a little above league average, but nothing absolutely insane. And the Lakers' offensive rating is around league average in those minutes. So even with the construction that they have in LA, with him playing bigger on offense, no Westbrook and no AD, that offense has not been particularly good this year. So I land on, like, I don't really know what to do with them, but I think I'm going to go with my nine guys ahead of them. How do you feel?
Yeah, I think that's fine. And, you know, you all just heard me. I apparently can't get too excited on this episode. And if I do, I'll slowly just start leaning in and maybe I'll start, like, whispering my takes like, oh, I really think LeBron James might be competing for number seven. So if that starts happening, don't freak. I'm saving myself for future episodes.
No, I think whispering puts more strain on the vocal cords, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, probably not shouting. I'm guessing the cracking means that it's like it's breaking down. I'm basically like Anthony Davis's body at this point. Like, how much can you take?
Well, oh my goodness, too soon. That was too soon. We need to call in a vocal coach immediately to get to the bottom of this. So okay, we've talked about Tatum, we've talked about LeBron. Who else is in this kind of outside looking in group for you that's kind of fuzzy?
Man, I have some names that here's a question.
Here's a question
I actually have for you, Ben, because I was thinking about this because I was actually looking at a lot of regular season numbers for this, right? Going back a couple of years, maybe looking at it from this year. But are you conceiving of like a Lone Star Helio guy in the playoffs, or are you like a regular season, this is the kind of Lone Star player that can buoy a team and carry you to, I don't know, 45 to 50 wins pretty well?
I don't know if my mind has gotten to that level of sophistication with this concept. Here's why. It's not easy to me to make that translation because, one, playoff sample sizes are super small when it comes to looking at Lone Star numbers. If you're on a team, like let's say Dallas last year, actually, it's a perfect example. You would think, oh, what about like Luka Doncic's team or James Harden's team when they go to the conference finals and everything runs through them and they play the same way? It's like, yeah, well, Chris Paul's out there a lot too. So it's still a small sample when you remove Chris Paul from the Rockets. Last year with Luka, one of the things we talked about in their video in the spring after the trade, the Porzingis trade, is how they put extra ball handlers on the floor. So he's out there with Jalen Brunson a ton. He's out there with Spencer Dinwiddie. And oh, by the way, Jalen Brunson, just like in prior years with Dallas, he's one of these dudes that this season, nearly 30 points per 75, plus 6% true shooting when Julius Randle's off the floor. Small sample, but it's consistent with what we saw when Luka went off the court. So even guys like that in the playoffs, Cody, I have a hard time of being like, let me see all your Lone Star minutes, because when your team is good, you typically don't have a lot of Lone Star minutes. I've looked it up with Steph Curry historically, and it takes like 3 or 4 playoffs to get like 800 minutes or 500 minutes in the playoffs or something, because usually you want to have Klay Thompson on the court, you want to have Kevin Durant on the court when he was there, you want to have Jordan Poole on the court, so on and so forth.
Yeah, you have to make the finals, and actually you want to be playing your best player, so there's not enough time to actually see the data from having one guy out there. So with this playoff conversation out of the way, there's one guy who just like...
I did a good enough job that I could get a pass on that.
I just needed to bring it up because then I can throw out the person with all of my context. I did my proverbial throat clearing along with my other throat clearing here before I put this guy out here. But a player that I think in the regular season looks pretty solid when it comes to Lone Star stuff, but historically I think it's pretty iffy when it comes to his numbers holding, and that's DeMar DeRozan. I think
he did not make my... Yeah, he did not make my final cut this year for, I guess, what's going to be these top 9 guys who I feel comfortable about. I mean, DeRozan is someone who has a history of his scoring going down a good amount in the postseason and his efficiency going down a good amount in the postseason. And last year, of course, was no different. And this season, his Lone Star numbers, again, during the regular season, are pretty good. Actually, they're fantastic. Mm-hmm. 33 points per 75 on +6% true shooting when Zach LaVine goes to the bench in about 600 minutes. But again, Cody, it's one of those things where, okay, so we did the throat clearing for the playoffs, and we don't really know how to handle that because of sample and things like that. But I just look at the regular season with DeRozan, and I see the 116 offensive rating when LaVine goes to the bench, which if you're not paying attention, the 116 offensive rating isn't that much above league average. We forgot to start the show with our typical announcement of offensive rating. And the offensive rating in the last month, Cody, is up to what?
I didn't check it today, Ben. I didn't check it today yet.
But yesterday it was 116.3.
116
yesterday, which happens
3.
Yeah, which happens to be the Bulls' offensive rating with DeMar DeRozan on the court and Zach LaVine on the bench. So again, these are good. I really like that call out of DeRozan. I'm not sure I feel as comfortable with him being sort of my one man offensive centerpiece as the 9 guys we're going to get to.
And then there's a couple other guys. One of them I pretty comfortably put into my top 9, so I'm a little nervous about bringing him up, but I'll still say his name here. But these two guys have had some injury issues, a little bit smaller of a sample size. Doesn't necessarily, I don't know, like last year one of these guys played like 30 games and didn't look very good, but he seems to be right back to where he was before, and he had some great numbers before, and that's Damian Lillard. And the other one, who again, when I was looking at Drew Holiday a couple of years ago, I think this is back when Russell Westbrook was a teammate on the Wizards, Bradley Beal, when Westbrook was off the court, then Bradley Beal was really ramping up, and he still seems to, in much smaller sample, still seems to be able to ramp up his game quite a bit. So those are two guys who, like, historically I was like, smaller sample size, but I still think they've got it if they had a bigger chance.
I think today has to be a day of reading stats, just because so many people don't know the numbers that we're alluding to when guys are on and off the court. Beal, for me, 29 points per 75, +6%, but he doesn't have the playmaking or the shot creation. He doesn't really have that component to shift into at the higher levels. So not someone for me that cracked the top 9. And who is the other fellow you said? Damian Lillard?
Yeah, Damian Lillard.
Yeah, so I've reached the age where now I just say fella. That's how I refer to basketball players. Apparently, his numbers this year are ridiculous. You're saying, though, he's not in your top 9.
No, I'm saying that I felt more comfortable with him. I didn't want to say him right now because I think he is in my top 9, but because of last year, it's one of those where you pull like a multi-year thing and he looks worse because last year he was struggling with an injury, didn't play as many minutes, but I think this season is more indicative of what he actually is. That's my opinion of what I've seen from Damian Lillard.
Yeah, he is in my top 9, but this is a rapidly shifting you know, on the fly, I have no idea what I'm doing kind of list. But Lillard this season in a very small sample is he's got 340 minutes without Anthony Simons and Anfernee Simons, and he's like 37 plus 9 scoring. The Blazers' offensive rating is 131. But last year, it was in the other direction. Last year, it was terrible. You know, like last year, the offensive rating was down. His numbers were way down. So I don't know if I've ever seen a multi-year stretch from Dame going back to when I pulled these numbers a couple years ago, 2019, 2020, that would make me think like, oh, he's near the upper echelon of this group. But I do have him. I do have him in the top nine. Let me ask you, I want to ask you about someone with respect to Damian Lillard. But first, I want to ask you about two other players. They're often compared to each other. How do you feel about Devin Booker and Donovan Mitchell in this conversation?
So, ultimately,
when they're the lone star, when they're the lone star on the court, when you have to rely on them for your offensive heavy lifting, how do you feel about those guys?
When we had our top 10 offensive players in the league episode, which we talked about last year, I don't remember where he landed, but I'm pretty sure you and I felt confident that Donovan Mitchell was higher than Devin Booker, right? And I think Devin Booker seems to be, at least when he plays, we haven't seen Devin Booker for a little while, so again, much smaller sample size. But at that time, we felt pretty confident that Donovan Mitchell was a better lone star player and was able to ramp up considerably in the playoffs. Like, he had a couple of, like, literal all-time scoring seasons, maybe only a couple of rounds, but this is a guy that I really believe in. This is a guy that, personally, for me, Donovan Mitchell made my top nine when we're talking about this top nine. And Devin Booker, I felt, was sort of a little bit further behind, maybe wherever, like, the DeMar DeRozan. When you bring in the playoffs, like, I'd still take Devin Booker's offense over DeMar DeRozan, but in the context of, like, regular season, lone star, creation type stuff, in the back, little past 10 area.
Okay, so for Booker, but Mitchell's in your top nine.
Yeah, Mitchell made my top nine.
Okay, so I think one of the things that's interesting about those two guys is Booker has, not that Mitchell doesn't, we talked about this last year, so we won't rehash it, but Booker has a game where he can play off of other ball dominant players and take some playmaking responsibility. But as we saw with the pressure that Dallas was able to exert against him in the playoffs last season, that's not his strength as a player. And I think it's reflected in some of his lone star numbers that we look at. So for instance, this season, 650 minutes, his load goes up only a little bit when Chris Paul goes to the bench. His scoring goes up only a little bit. He goes from about 28 to 30 points per 75, and his efficiency is slightly on the positive side. And so even though he's doing more, he's creating more offense, I like more of what I'm seeing from him this season on that front, as he's, you know, steadily improved as an offensive player over the last couple seasons. But it still seems a little short of the model you get with Mitchell. And, you know, maybe when Darius Garland's been injured, that's been on display more front and center than it would be if you just look at lineup data, because Mitchell's now played about half the year with Garland and half the year without him. He's about 750 minutes with Garland in the game and about 650 minutes with Garland on the bench. And he has a massive jump, Cody. He goes from offensive load of 41, which means he's creating or scoring 41% of the time for his offense, basically up to 57. That is a huge number. And his scoring jumps from about 28 per 75 to nearly 33 points per 75. The passing gets better. The shot creation explodes. He still takes his 10 threes a game. He gets to the line more. So I think it's pretty close, but Mitchell feels like a guy that you can lean on. And the skills we've talked about in the past, where it goes back to the 71-point game video that I did. His mastery of understanding how to manipulate screen defenses, reject the screen, his quickness, his actual shooting as a pull-up shooter or off-ball shooter, which, as we've said many times, is statistically ahead of Booker, even though they have the opposite reputation. I think I would side Mitchell here, but I'm not I don't think I would put him in my top nine. So now I'm interested in who gets bumped out.
That's really interesting. I don't even know who's bumped out. I don't know who's in it to be bumped out, but on that point,
I don't know either. I don't know who's in it either.
I think the thing with Mitchell that I like more than Booker is Booker, like you said, traditionally likes to get into his mid-range spots and pull up from those, and not that Mitchell doesn't like to pull up a lot. I think he shoots a little bit more, a higher percent of his shots from three, but I think he also just has a better ability to get to the basket when he needs to. He can drive and really draw on defenses more than Booker, like a streaking Donovan Mitchell has to be one of the more terrifying things to defend in the NBA, because we've seen him be able to, his body control on some of these finishes, the way that he's able to sidestep with his Euros, his incredible athleticism and long arms just allow him to just detonate on players, just huge dunks. And Booker, I think his driving and finishing ability look better than they have the last couple of seasons. I like his ability to get all the way to the rim. I just don't think he quite has that. He doesn't strike that fear into an opposing offense that would draw multiple defenders for a sort of kickout. So I think that's a huge element that really biases me towards Donovan Mitchell in this conversation.
Okay, there are three players that I'm dying to talk about.
Okay.
I don't know which one to go to first. They're all too enticing. Let's start with Kevin Durant.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about Kevin Durant in this conversation? I will sort of preface this by saying, in his greatest peaks profile, I talked about how I see him as a hybrid, meaning he has on-ball sort of electricity and can provide value there, but he has a ton of off-ball game. All-time, you know, we talked about our top shooters of all time recently. That was a super fun episode. Kevin Durant, one of the best shooters of all time. His wide-open shooting numbers in the last couple seasons are hilarious. They're like 49%. On threes, he doesn't get that open often on his threes, but he, you know, his mid-range is like in the 50-something percent sort of club because he's an incredible shooter and 90% from the free throw line and all this kind of stuff. But if you have to rely on him to carry your offense, do you think he's one of the 9 or 10 best players in the league right now?
I put him there. I said he was in the top nine. I think his Lone Star numbers are just spectacular. Like you said, like 10 years ago, like pre-MVP, right when he won MVP, Durant, people would have been like, this is one of the best shooting seven-footers of all time. And I think when you have a really good skill, you know, it's harder to notice the improvements. Like, you see somebody like Paul George, Jaylen Brown, these guys who, like, came in, didn't really have a strong handle, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, wow, if you look back, you can really see these big changes. Kevin Durant, coming in as like a fantastic shooter, as a somebody built that way, he's gone up a level with the shooting, like you said. Like, it's unreal how he's able to control the game just because you constantly have to guard him, and basically it doesn't matter if you guard him. Like, you can be right up on him and he can just rise up over you. And I think that helps some of his passing angles. I do think what hurts him more is when you go back to like 2014 MVP sort of Kevin Durant, his driving game was a little bit more aggressive. I think he was able to get to the basket more. And that was even in a worse spacing context than we've seen. Not that the Nets are like a great spacing team. They have some of the best shooters in the league, but they have a couple lineups where they struggle to space when Ben Simmons and Nick Claxton are out there. But if there's one thing where you're like, This makes me concerned about Durant, it's the fact that I don't think he can drive and get to the basket quite as well, but the shooting and I think his passing ability is good enough that I'm comfortable having him in my top nine.
Okay, I also have him in my top nine, but I think it's interesting because I don't think it's as idealized of a role mm-hmm. for him, despite him being one of the best offensive players in the sport, and I don't have him up at sort of the top of the list. And his two-year numbers as the Lone Star, he's had plenty of time out there with guys like Kyrie Irving missing time and even James Harden missing time when they all play together. His two-year numbers, 31 points per 75, 65% true shooting, but his passing and his creation numbers, he's not going to be that traditional heliocentric hub that can just take a ton of playmaking load. The Nets offensive rating in those two seasons with him as the Lone Star on the court are 117. It is 117. That's the offensive efficiency mark. That's pretty good. So I think overall I have Durant in there as well. Can I ask you about the next guy that I'm just fascinated to discuss?
Please. I feel Desmond. Coy saying it because there's a name that I feel attached to that we haven't gotten to, and the longer that we don't talk about him, the more nervous I'm getting here.
Okay. Do you want to mention that name? I don't want you to be nervous.
No, I think the nerves help me, Ben. The fear is what drives the podcast. So we're gonna leave him unnamed. You tell me, who are you gonna bring up?
Well, no, I want to talk about John Morant.
Okay.
Because you mentioned Desmond Bain, and I think Morant is really fascinating because I would say much like what I said about Tatum earlier, he's a really interesting example of a player who is playing closer to probably his max sort of Lone Star capacity, even with other players out on the court already. So that means that despite Bane being on the floor, his offensive load doesn't change much when Bane goes to the bench. It only goes up by a couple percentage points. And he's already kind of playing that, like, a lot, you know, create a lot, get the ball, try to touch the paint, massive rim pressure. If I can score, I can score. If I can kick it out, if I can lay it down, if I can set up my teammates. And so the difference there in terms of, hey, Bane, you go to the bench, or, you know, Tyus Jones, they don't play a lot of minutes together, but like Tyus Jones, Bane's other shot creators and ball handlers aren't on the court anymore. Ja, you're going to do what you do. To me, we kind of already see something close to that with the full functioning Grizzlies anyway. And I would say I have very high sort of regard for Ja as an offensive player right now. So I would say that's like very good, but I'm not sure how that compares against the very best.
He was actually one of my players that was right on the bubble here. I really wanted
He's my 9-10.
Yeah.
When I said 9 or 10 earlier, he's my 9-10, yeah.
100%. Because if you think about it, like, the driving ability, no one can stay in front of this guy. Just unbelievable burst, handle, like, the ball on a string. And I think his passing is I don't know if underrated is the right way. No, everyone can't be underrated, Ben. When we're describing something that somebody's good at, they can't all be underrated. It's like when everyone's like, I'm a better driver than average. Like, someone has to be worse than average, you know?
No, if we bring it up on this show, they're underrated. That's
okay.
That's sort of, yeah, that's a good rule to live by.
I like that. So Ja Morant is underrated in his passing, I believe. I think he's a spectacular passer. I think he's able to create a lot of clean looks for his teammates, but the shooting makes me a little bit concerned. I think he's able to get to the basket and he can sky and finish, but I don't know. He didn't quite crack that top nine for me.
Well, I don't know if you need as much outside shooting when you're the lone star out there doing all the slicing and dicing and kicking. And now I sound like I've been watching Walt Frazier Nick broadcast for the last week or so. He's doing a lot of dishing and feasting and fishing. And but that's John Morant for you. He is a sleek and unstoppable force getting to the basket. So maybe that's a great segue into the third guy I'm fascinated to discuss. I don't know who this player you're thinking of is. Given our prior podcasts, it's very likely that this is a player that's not on my list. Mm-hmm. And you're gonna be like, Ben, we have to talk about Domantas Sabonis as the Lone Star King of the NBA. The third player I'm fascinated to talk about relates to what I just said with Ja Morant, and that is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander in Oklahoma City, subject of a recent deep dive Thinking Basketball profile on our YouTube channel.
I was going to say, you just made a video on him. You've been really steeped, Ben, in the Shai Gilgeous-Alexander film. What are your thoughts in this conversation with him?
I mean, I think the role that he's playing this season in Oklahoma City, for the most part, is closer to him being optimized, maximized as a Lone Star sort of Helio player. But this is a Sir Mix-a-Lot level but coming up. His numbers with Josh Giddey on and off the court radically change, which is wild to me. This is what's really interesting. In fact, I would have to say, before I even read some of these numbers, it's guaranteed that there's noise involved. I mean, we 400, 700 minutes, and we know there's going to be noise and things like that. But when I read these numbers, you like, it is guaranteed that these are not real numbers. This is noise, wacky doodle. Boy, I've had some crazy vocabulary decisions in this show today. It's because of the new camera. That's what it is. The new camera is really throwing me off. I have to look at myself in HD. I don't like what I see. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander with Josh Giddey on the floor. People should be talking about this. This is nuts. The Thunder are being outscored by 5 points per 100 possessions when those two guys play together, Shai and Josh Giddey. Josh Giddey, of course, is coming on a little bit lately. He's building some steam. We have Giddey Watch here at the Thinking Basketball podcast, so we've been monitoring this. Together, they're being outscored by 5 points per 100. But then when Josh Giddey goes to the bench, the Thunder outscore teams by 9 points per 100. That's just nonsense. That's not real numbers. Those things have to regress, I would think, in the opposite direction. Let me stop there. That's just weird.
Not only that, but their offense balloons by like 5 points, and Shai himself individually, because you'd think like with Josh Giddey, you're like, oh, this guy's greasing the grooves, he's getting you open shots, he's the type of guy you want to play with, but Shai just loses a smidge, Ben, of efficiency and skyrockets his scoring and is able to create like twice as many attempts for his teammates. So he looks like a dramatically different player. He looks like a certified superstar when Giddey's on the bench.
It's nuts. He goes from 26 points per 75 up near 36 points per 75. The efficiency doesn't change. He creates a ton of shots. The thing I will say about doing the deep dive is I think we have to be careful, and this will come up with another player in a minute. I think we have to be careful with saying, well, the more you score when you're the lone star out there, the better, right? The more you score, the better. Because heliocentrism and success in basketball, it isn't just about juicing your own stats. It's about creating the most effective system for the team, and often precisely when you are the lone star out there on the court doing all the heavy lifting, it's your passing and your playmaking that separate you, you know, separate the wheat from the chaff, that actually gets you really good offense. It goes back to discussions we've had about Magic Johnson or Steve Nash. We were talking about it when we were talking about, when we were talking about Jokic as the best scorer and the best playmaker in the league. And we were saying, when else has that come up? And it's like Steve Nash, when you like, he's an underrated scorer precisely because he was constantly making passes that were just, he was like a layup machine. He's like, here, you have a layup. He was like Oprah giving out layups. He's like, you have a layup, you have a layup, we all have layups. That was Steve Nash. So I think precisely when you are in this position as a lone star on the court, your passing is so important. And I was a little underwhelmed with SGA as a passer relative to how good he's become at everything else. And I think that's a big thing to kind of think about here when contextualizing, like, whoa, this dude's scoring numbers when he's out there by himself are insane.
Well, let me ask you, as a fellow spreadsheet diver, somebody that likes to immerse yourself, take nice lavender baths in the numbers. I got to ask you.
I don't like them. Yeah. I like a quick shower in the spreadsheet, then I'm out of there.
Let the numbers rain on you. You don't want to like sift in it like you're steeping yourself as a tea.
I know you put some lavender in there and you light some candles and you spend a couple hours in the spreadsheet, but I got to get in and out real fast.
So, okay. So as a spreadsheet showerer, then, I got to ask you, looking at all these numbers, you just referenced the individual scoring. We don't necessarily want to get too excited about individual scoring and equate that with being a good helio guy. But the one number that I just find so interesting when it comes to these players is looking at the team offensive rating when they're the lone star. How much do you bias towards that? How much does that excite you when you're looking at these kinds of numbers? Are you like really looking at that first and then individual numbers and then combining that with everything you've seen? Or how do you factor that into your assessment here?
Ooh, that's a great question, because I think I would look at the net rating first and then attach the offensive rating to the net rating because of that LeBron James thing we talked about. Because what I've seen over the years is sometimes you remove one of the stars from the equation, the lineups change a little bit. And that means without, you know, deep diving in the lineup data, I mean, Cody, you're talking about taking baths and spreadsheets. If I'm going to bathe in anything in basketball tabling, it's going to be lineup data and trying to figure out who's playing with who, what their opponents were, things like that. And so what you see in all seriousness is, well, this guy's playing with bench units against bench units, and everyone's defensively oriented. And we're asking, I'll just make up a player so there's no controversy here. We're asking Manu Ginobili to play with all these defenders. And therefore, what I care about first and foremost is contextualizing, like, is the lineup still successful when no other good offensive stars are out there? Oh, you're outscoring teams by 5 points per 100, and Tim Duncan are on the bench, and Tony Parker's on the bench, and Brent Barry's not even in these lineups. You don't have good. It's just like all D. You have like Devin Brown and Nazi Muhammad and Bruce Bowen, and I'm doing my best to remember Spurs from 15 years ago. So hang in there with me. But like, you see what I'm getting at, Cody? If I see that you are outscoring teams by 5 points per 100, and then I go over and I check the offensive rating, and it's 10 points below your offensive rating when you play with the starters, I don't immediately go, oh, you stink at offense, you must be amazing at defense. I try to contextualize that and say, okay, well, maybe he's just out there with guys who are defensively slanted. And I think the exact same inverse holds true, where sometimes you can play with off, like that thing we talked about with LeBron, the lineup gets offensively slanted. And so I do look at that number. It does have noise when you only have a few hundred minutes. If you get up to 1,800 minutes, I feel more comfortable. But I always contextualize it with the overall performance, which is why I'm saying, like, I can't buy that the Thunder are a plus nine team when Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's on the court and Josh Giddey happens to be off the court. There's one, that doesn't compute. Two, the samples are small enough, we know noise is likely. And three, that would mean if you just get rid of that Giddey fella and just let the season roll out, the Thunder will be in the Western Conference Finals, no problem.
Yeah, that's obviously the conclusion you should reach here. But a point that I want to sit on for a second that I think is really important here is that even when you do these exercises that seem to be just about offense, we're only talking about like the Helio offensive type guy, it's still impossible to completely separate offense and defense. They always sort of bleed into each other. There's part of it that's informing the other part of it. You know, defense, for instance, like you said, the lineup data, you could see a team that has really high offensive rating, but they put everyone in that can play offense, their defense rating is even higher than that, so they're running at like a negative three net rating. Or even on defense, you got guys like you can generate easy baskets by getting steals, running a pick six sort of situation, getting one on O transitions and scoring these hyper efficient offensive possessions. So I just think that's really interesting. It's even when you try and separate it, it is impossible to fully separate the two of offense and defense.
Okay, so would you rather have the Shai Gilgeous-Alexander model we just discussed, where you have someone who wants to dominate the ball to a certain degree? He doesn't need to have it in his hands, 55% of the time they're in the half court or something, but he has the ball a lot. He likes to attack in the middle of the floor. He likes the floor spread the way the Thunder spread it out for him. He's scoring at the rim. He's scoring in the mid-range. He's scoring off pull-ups. He's scoring off his own action. And then he's creating offense for others, but not maybe like the best passers and playmakers in the sport. Would you rather have that as your backbone for a heliocentric system? Maybe surround that with a few shooters and see what happens? Or would you rather have what we talked about earlier with Kevin Durant, that kind of like hybrid, you know, this dude can just get his own points, but, you know, who's a better playmaker between Durant and Shai when they both have the basketball in their hand? Don't make me choose, but like, maybe Durant. I don't know. It's they're not at the level of the other guys we're gonna get to.
That's such a, when you put the names to it, that's such a tough question, because I just have all the memories of being like, Kevin Durant is hyper successful in the playoffs. It works. I don't see all of that with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. So I want to just say Kevin Durant sort of archetype, but I don't necessarily know if that's the case if we're truly going with archetypes. But having a guy that's 7 feet tall and can do those things is that's pretty cool. That works pretty well for your offense.
He's not 7 feet. He's 6'9½" barefoot. And if he's 7 feet, then how tall is the guy who plays in Milwaukee?
What do you think about the guy in Milwaukee?
How tall is he? Is he 7'1"? No. What are we doing with him? What are we doing with him? Giannis Antetokounmpo, one of the most fascinating cases here. And I will lay out my thought process with him. As of now, I reserve the right to change my mind on the fly as we have this discussion. I have him ahead of all the players we've talked about. You don't agree. You don't have him ahead of him.
Keep going.
Okay, well, so here's my thought process with him. We know that he's a massive scorer, just massive scorer. And just to put some numbers on it, with Drew Holiday off the court this season, 34 points per 75, right around his typical efficiency for the year, which is near league average. But if you look at the two-year numbers, Cody, over the last two seasons, he's played almost 900 minutes without Chris Middleton and Drew Holiday. So it's a decent little sample. And Giannis is averaging 34 points per 75 on about plus 2% efficiency, and the assists go up. He's almost at 10 assists per 100. We just have seen the concept of a Giannis-centered offense. We know what it is. Transition offense, clear out the court. It's not your favorite offense. We've talked about it, but it's similar to Shai geometrically in that you want to get him spots in the middle of the floor, allow him to attack into those areas, and then surround him with shooters that he can kick out to. He continues to grow as a passer, in my mind, just a little bit every year, 2019 to 2021 to 2023. His passing has stepped up slowly, the decision-making. So we know he can score. We know he can play make. The trickiest part about what to do with him is the team's offensive rating is like never very good in those situations. And I think some of that is surrounding him with defenders. But as you know, as the spirit of heliocentrism and the history of kind of the idea, if you get 3-and-D players and you get a couple shooters, you shouldn't have an offense that's 3, 4, 5 points per 100 worse than league average. And that's what we're looking at with these Giannis numbers when he's the lone star on the court.
So
I broke Cody.
I think about Giannis a lot, Ben. I think about this Bucks team, and that's the thing that always holds me back. And I know this is maybe outside of the spirit of the Helio conversation, but I'm pretty sure somebody that's like steeped more in the numbers, that like sleeps with a spreadsheet and mask on at night and somehow just like knows them through osmosis, you can call me out. But I feel like if you go back to some lineup data type situations over the last few years, is that lineups without Giannis that include like Drew and Chris are generally better on offense. Like the whole lineup itself isn't better. Their defenses are off the charts when Giannis is on the court, but the offense always seems to slip down a little bit. And that includes when he's the lone star. And so Giannis kind of lands in this Jason Tatum category where I think in my head, I'm like, I might be biasing more towards him because he has such an immense impact on the defensive side as well. Like comparatively to these other lone stars that we're talking about, Giannis, Jason Tatum, especially Giannis though, because he's defensive player of the year level type of candidate. His defensive ability in being a lone star is really, really tremendous. So you can kind of buoy a weaker than average offensive lineup, this kind of battering ram. I'm going to be pouring in points. I'm going to be fouling out your guys. I need you to be strong. But ultimately, we're going to be making up the points on the defensive end where we're going to be much stronger. So I didn't know what to do with that. I genuinely, Ben, don't know where to put him in this conversation.
Cody, I don't know where to put anybody in this conversation. I think if we're talking about Giannis and the concept of creating sort of Giannis ball that we've seen the Bucks go to, once again, Cody is not a fan of this offense because, as we've discussed before, Giannis as a play finisher, Giannis as a screener, Giannis as an offensive rebounder, as a vertical rim threat, these are all things that give him a ton of value that allow him to synergize with the other offensive stars on the court, like Jrue Holiday, like Chris Middleton. But we're talking about something different. We're talking about him as the lone star. What about Zion Williamson?
That's it? Okay. I said that because in retrospect, I'm playing that whole scene in my head, and it probably just seems like I just like checked out. Like my soul just left my body, and I'm just going autopilot for the rest of this thing. Like, oh, Zion, yep, that's another player. All right.
Yes, he plays for New Orleans.
Let me give you thoughts about Zion. Wow. I was just about to say something. Now I'm like, wow, people are going to listen to this and have comments about it. But is it hot to say that Zion's a better offensive player than Giannis? I feel like Zion's a better offensive player.
I feel like he is too. I feel like he's a better offensive player as well. But when we'll have a Pelicans video on this when he comes back, how much of that is him playing off other players who have to have a certain level of offensive competence to kind of unlock some of Zion's off-ball insanity? And how much of that is just, it doesn't matter the scenario, Zion's just a better offensive player, period.
We kind of talked about this before, where when you have like driving Giannis versus driving Zion, like Giannis goes into, like I said before, battering ram mode. Like, I'm going to probably not get called for a few offensive fouls, whereas Zion's just a little bit more nimble with his drives. He's a little bit more agile with getting his shoulder a little bit lower, bumps a guy off his spot, is able to raise up, can, I'm not going to say finish better, because Giannis is also just an otherworldly finisher, but I don't know, Ben. But,
well, the passing is the part to me that's tricky.
Yeah.
Because I think Giannis is clearly a better passer, and yet the things that Zion does with the ball still creates so much offense that I'm not sure how much playmaking, like I think he gives up some playmaking, and I think here's where the playoff thing comes into play. Giannis's improvement going back to 2019. I recently just rewatched the Giannis rules video we did in 2019 after the series against the Raptors, and he's clearly missing passes that he would make today. And I think what's key about that is it allowed the Raptors to play that defensive strategy against him, to use those quote-unquote Giannis rules against him without being punished as much. The better you are at making those passes, the more you can punish that kind of defensive help, that kind of defensive flooding toward the ball, et cetera, et cetera. So he's going to have that advantage. But I think it's safe to say, Cody, at this point, that Zion is kind of a more efficient offensive player. Like, you know, he doesn't bleed value by taking a ton of crazy long twos and threes, and he doesn't. What's Giannis shooting at the free throw line?
I'm not looking it up.
So, if you're not watching on YouTube, Cody is painfully furrowing his brow and rubbing his forehead. But like, I just think he's better in that area, and that's part of what makes him a quote unquote better offensive player in most situations. And so, even though his passing is still fairly basic and can and probably will improve as he gets more reps, they're similar as one man offenses to me. And New Orleans doesn't even necessarily surround him with great shooters. I think if you were to surround him with great shooters and be like, Zion, you go play with Brooke Lopez as your stretch five and Chris Middleton, who's an amazing shooter himself, and whatever the facsimile of Grayson Allen has, who has been the prior Bucks playing that role. I can't be expected to remember this, but you know, you just put shooters out there around him. Boy, if they were a one man offense, that's tough for me. That's tough.
It's tough, but I will go out on a limb and say that wherever you would have Giannis, I might have Zion higher.
Slightly higher, right?
Yeah.
Zion this year with Brandon Ingram and CJ McCollum on the bench. Just under 300 minutes, so very small sample. The Pelicans are plus 11 per 100. They have a 119 offensive rating. Zion, he's not good at basketball. This is Zion. 31 points per 75, plus 8% true shooting. His free throws go up, 11 free throws per 75. And I would say, just anecdotally from scouting the Pelicans, he has this ability to shift into give me the ball every time, set some screens for me, and it's just chaos because you need like three players to stop Zion Williamson from getting to the basket. He's absolutely supernatural at exploding into the paint, getting through creases, things like that. He's done it down the stretch in huge games this season and taken over the game that way. So I feel like I've kind of talked myself into exactly what you just said. Like, wherever we put Giannis, maybe Zion goes a little bit higher.
Okay, so we're an hour in now, Ben. I think it's time to just end the episode. I don't think the people actually want us to talk about the top 10. I think we should probably just hang out in the fringes and talk about all of these players and see how they react. What do you think about that?
Wait a second. This isn't your top 10? I've been going through my top 10 this whole time.
We've missed a couple of people. We're definitely leaving out the cream of the crop if we're not talking the top 10.
I've left out my top four. And then there's one name, and I don't know if this is a name that you wanted to talk about. There's one name that it's going to bother some people, but I think you legit have to talk about this. If you are saying heliocentric offense, lone star, you know, surround him with some shooters, whatever it is, I think we have to figure out what to do with James Harden. Was that the name you were getting nervous about earlier?
No, I was getting nervous about Giannis. I didn't know how harsh we were going to be when we talked about him. I don't know if it's a hot take. I think James Harden's been very good offensively this year. He hasn't been peak Helio James Harden, but you know, when I watch him, like I think I sent you a pass he made the other day, and obviously one play doesn't set it up, but it was, my goodness, like that guy can throw some nice, like across the body left-handed passing. I think it was like to a streaking Tyrese Maxey or something for a layup, but James Harden's Helio ball has looked pretty solid. Like he's not, you know, I went back and I watched a little bit of say like the 2017 Rockets, and Harden is, he's a little bit bigger than he used to be, but he's still got the skill, right? He's still a tremendous passer. He can still shoot the ball. He has some nice synergy at moments with Embiid. Embiid actually looks better at times when he's on the court with Harden. I don't know. I think to me it was pretty easy to put Harden in my top nine.
Okay, I had him there as well, and then I can't figure out, like, I feel comfortable not having him in the top four that we're gonna briefly get to in a second. Yeah. But I'm also like James Harden versus Kevin Durant. Who would you rather build the offense around right now?
I mean, that's a tough question. Build an offense around? I would rather take Kevin Durant.
But I phrased that poorly. Yeah, build an offensive round as the lone star. Let me attach the key part to it.
I don't know. I don't know if this Harden thing's somewhat of a blip, because I know, again, last couple of seasons he had some of those hamstring issues. He looked a little bit slower. Kevin Durant just seems like he's been rolling along right now. I don't know. Maybe I'm just leaning with Kevin Durant because I think he's overall a better offensive player, but I don't know. I would probably say Kevin Durant still, but I could be wrong. I could be wrong about that.
Okay. Let's finish up with the, I had four guys that I think I feel the most comfortable about. God, as I say that out loud, now I'm not even sure that I feel the most comfortable about these four guys. They're just the four guys we haven't talked about. What do you do with this is so painful. What do you do with Harden's teammate, Joel Embiid?
Yes. That, to me, they were like tethered in my ranking. I couldn't separate the two. I just couldn't. But then I was like, is the concept of like Helio ball, like Embiid isn't necessarily being like the Sabonis type of Helio ball where he's doing like the DHO thing. He's more like, I can't get over how smooth Joel Embiid's jump shot looks. Like, it blows my mind to watch this guy play and like dribble into a Hezzy pull-up Jimbo, and it's just like butter. Just butter. Not margarine, Ben. It's butter just sifting through the net. And it blows my mind. I don't know how that's relevant to any of this, but Joel Embiid's offense, I don't know. There are times where he looks better with Harden. I think we talked about that. Some of his Harden on numbers look a little bit better. His passing numbers leave a little bit more to be desired, especially relative to some of these other mega creators. I really didn't know what to do with him. So like I said, I just kind of put him next to Harden.
Okay. All right. That's fair. We should let everyone know that Joel Embiid, when Harden and Maxey are off the floor, just kind of looks like Joel Embiid.
Yeah.
That's the interesting thing. 33 points per 75, plus 3% true shooting. His shot creation and things like that is similar to, you know, his normal. I think it goes up a little bit, actually, when they go to the bench. But, I mean, it's just kind of like your standard Joel Embiid offense. And I think the thing that holds me back is what I said earlier about the scoring, where look at how he draws defensive attention. And some of this might be the 76ers X's and O's holding him back, but it's not what we see from Sabonis. It's not what we see in Denver. It's not guys like that. So like he's a very good floor raiser, but how high, you know, without great passing and playing that kind of style that he plays, can you be a really good offense? That's kind of what holds me back with Embiid and makes me think I'd actually kind of prefer Harden if I had a Lone Star system because of the passing.
Yeah, as you're talking, I'm sitting here looking at it like, what am I doing? Like, Harden is clearly the better Lone Star in this situation.
Right.
That's clearly the answer. Let me ask you something.
Yeah.
Who would you rather have as a Lone Star? Would you rather have Zion or Embiid?
Well, as of now, I have them written down next to each other.
Okay.
My hunch, I'm going to get crazy.
Ooh, okay.
Embiid's two-year Lone Star numbers, the offensive rating there in Philly is 113. It's one of the lowest multi-year numbers on the board for these guys up at the top. I think I'm going to get crazy and say Zion.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think while you were talking, I was thinking that as well. I had Embiid higher, but the more that we're talking, I'm like, I think I would trust Zion more.
I've kind of talked myself into this. This is really tricky. So, okay. So let me try something, Cody. Let me run something. Let me workshop something as we get close to the end of the episode. Number 10, Dame Lillard. Number 9, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Number 8, Joel Embiid. And we all see how fluid these are. This is impossible. I'm just trying to lay out, based on what we've talked about, a kind of ordering that makes sense. Number 7, Giannis. Number 6, Zion. I think I like the idea of just letting Zion go nuclear right now. The flashes I've seen. I mean, he's such a good offensive player.
It's unreal.
As well, he's such a good offensive player. I think I'm going to go old reliable. I think if you give James Harden, just on the offensive side of the ball, an offense and let him cook and pass. I mean, it's not like 35 points per 75 like the old days, but his number, 29 points per 75 plus 5% when Embiid goes to the bench, really one of the best passers in the league, 76ers offensive rating, 117. They're outscoring opponents. Like that's like his sweet spot. You know, he's still got a lot of ability to heavy lift there. How does that feel before we... And then did we say Durant? Durant's there? Four? I don't know.
I'm not even going to comment on whether or not I agree. I'm looking at my listings. I'm looking at my rankings. I'm just never going to reveal them to the world ever. What you said makes sense at this point.
Okay, good. I was hoping to do the whole show without actually having to reveal any rankings.
I didn't push you.
Trust me. Trust me. When we started the show, it was not a ranking show, but it was very hard to figure out how we were going to do this without saying a bunch of names and everyone averages 30 points per 75 possessions. So we wanted to put some constraints on it. And it's really hard, but I just want to kind of summarize everything we've talked about. The three players we haven't talked about, who to me, I think I would say, what's a flag? There's a flag on the play.
I'm calling my 22nd time. I don't know how to call a 20. I'm calling a 22nd timeout here. There's one guy who's not going to make this top three that we haven't talked about yet. And I wasn't sure what to do with him either. Ben, I can't believe he
hasn't. Wait a second. Who is this? I don't know who you're talking about.
I'm actually really interested. I'm going to throw out a name to you. Is he in your top three? Which means one of my top three isn't even in the discussion. I'm confused.
Is it Franz Wagner? No.
Yes, he's number one on my list, Ben. Franz Wagner, number
Who
one.
Who is this?
Trae Young. What are you doing with Trae Young? We're not even going to talk about Trae Young?
That's how
I felt. That's why I wanted to bring him up.
I forgot about Trae Young. Yeah. Now people say, with Ben, you forgot about Trae Young. He was literally the first person I researched. He's at the top of my list. I just kind of forgot about where to put him. What do you make of his like efficiency right now as a scorer? What do you make of that?
I'm not sure. The Heat series like broke him last year. Like ever since then, he hasn't been making shots at his usual clip. So I'm really not sure, because I legitimately thought he looked better than this in prior years and even in the playoffs. Like it's not like last year showed that he can't function in the playoffs. So I'm confused about it, Ben. I genuinely am.
Okay, I think mathematically he's shown enough as a passer, playmaker, spread pick and roll, pull-up shooting, that he's better on offense in this role especially than almost everyone we've named, if not everyone. Mm-hmm. Like that's his sweet spot. That's what he does. And does it get super weird to me that in the minutes he's played with DeJounte Murray on the bench this year, the Hawks are way worse and they have a lower offensive rating? I don't know what to make of that. Can we put Trae Young on the side? Can he just be on, like, he's in a different dimension. He's not part of these rankings. If he were, he'd probably go near the top, but I don't know what to do with him right now.
Yeah, what's some business speak we can say about him? We're going to table him. We're going to
table
Let's
it.
Put Trae
we're
Young table. In the parking lot. Pin.
Yeah, we're going to put a pin in Trae Young.
Okay, good. I needed to reference him. Good. I feel a lot more comfortable about the three players you're going to say then.
Okay, my number three is Steph Curry.
Yeah, okay, same here.
Yeah. He's shown historically an absurd ability to take on heavy loads when he's the only guy out there, ramp up his scoring. I think I have some numbers in his greatest peaks profile about what happens when he plays without Klay Thompson and Kevin Durant. Just the last 2 years, like current Steph Curry, when he's out there without Jordan Poole and without Klay Thompson, Golden State is +9. So this is a great example of where the offensive rating is a little lower, but from watching the team so much and understanding the lineup context and looking deeper into the numbers, they just throw him out there with guys who are like not really serviceable offensive NBA players. And they're like, hey, you just make this thing work. So a 114 offensive rating when you're +9 in those conditions actually is pretty good, I think, in this role. And then he's still like a 31+3%, you know, pick and roll, pull up, spread, on ball, off ball, yeah, two man game, dribble hand, whatever you want to do. Whatever you want to do with him, you can do it. I think 2021 was the year where it was before kind of Jordan Poole ascended to the position he's been in. Klay Thompson was out the whole season, and you got to see something closer to Steph being like, what if I took 23s per 100 possessions? And he has lineups like that when he was a couple years prior, when he was younger, where he's averaging like close to 40 or 40. I think we should mention that. I have a database of players who I've done all kinds of runs on, you know, when one teammate's off the court, when two teammates are off the court. It's very, very rare to get up over 35 points per game. And Steph Curry a couple years ago was one of those guys. So I don't think he's quite as good as he was back then. But he's, if you want to build an offense around him and have him carry guys, I think he's pretty good.
It blows my mind that there were legitimate takes that's like, yeah, but what if he was the only offensive player on the team? What if he didn't have Draymond and Klay Thompson? Like, the fact that that was like a sentence that left people's mouths blows my mind, Ben. Steph Curry is a genius with the basketball.
Yeah, he's very good with the ball, as you mentioned. Number one, who's it going to be, Curry?
I'm really interested because I feel pretty solid in my pick for number one. I do. And I don't think you're going to pick him.
I know, I just don't know what to do. I think he let... You think it should, without a doubt, be Nikola Jokic, because Nikola Jokic is maybe the greatest offensive basketball player ever. Is that your take?
Yeah, that's basically my argument, yes.
Okay, and I think part of Nikola Jokic's brilliance is that he plays off of anyone, and so the better, you know, you have a point guard, you can play two-man game, you have an off-ball shooter, you can do... Like, in this case... You're just asking him to be the guy doing the heavy lifting. And this was closer to what he did last year. We know that if he wants to score more, he can just decide. Like, he just has that power. He can just decide and say, hey, I would like to score more. His two-year Lone Star numbers, Denver is plus +9 with him on the court with a 120 offensive rating. Cody, I think you and I could go play with Nikola Jokic and they would have a 120 offensive rating. And then the scoring part, that's what people maybe don't grok onto as easily. 29 points per 75 on 67% true shooting. 67% true shooting. Cody went 12 for 12 on two-point shots last night. He went 12 for 12. Is he going to have a perfect game this year? Is he going to play a game where he has no turnovers and doesn't miss a shot?
Didn't
that,
he?
I think, should be a Vegas line.
Didn't he?
No,
have
he went
one?
12 for 12 from two. Maybe. How many field goals did he?
It wasn't last night. I thought there was another game where he had a perfect game. Am I making
right, but
up?
I think it was lower. No, I think it was a lower number of field goals.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I think he had turnovers. I'm talking about a game where he's just like no turnovers and no misses tonight. Let's see what that does to good old basketball reference and game logs and things like that. So it's either him or Luka Doncic, who's just like a tailor-made one-man machine who can do it all. His two-year Lone Star numbers, Dallas is plus +7 with a 116 offensive rating. Has Dallas played with slightly more 3-and-D players than Denver? Maybe. I don't know. I don't even know if that's the best way to do this. Just look at like 1,000 minutes and say, this team's offensive rating is 120 and this team's 118 and the 120 is clearly better. I don't know. Flip a coin between those two guys. You make the argument. You think Jokic should be number one.
Here's my case. Here's my case for Jokic. I feel pretty strong about this. And this is why we should hail him as Helios, the sun god, in this situation, Ben. So everyone else, most everyone else that we talk about, the entire premise of them being a Lone Star Helio guy is like this conception of spread pick and roll. You run a pick and roll, you got shooters around, and you can kind of, you set them up, you have a lot of space to do it. But Jokic kind of flips this whole thing on its head. Like you said, obviously it's hyperbole. You can't throw me and you out there. Like, my back's bad enough that I don't even know if I could like sprint to the basket on a cut at this point. But still, he'd be able to find me, you know, right? But if you just had like players out there, you don't necessarily need shooters. You just need functional NBA players that can at the correct time run towards the basket and he will get them shots. So he like completely transcends the idea of what it means to be a Lone Star Helio guy and doesn't need for you to be like, all right, now we need a high pick and roll. Come get me. You guys go in the corners and we'll figure it out. It's like, nope. I'm going to go in the middle. You all just kind of decide to do things at random. And if it doesn't work out, I'm just going to kind of dribble around in like this half motion until I get to one of my hook shots. And I think like that sort of style, it's just Luka is one of the greatest like high pick and roll creation Helio guys we've ever seen. But Jokic is just like, it's just a different thing. We're just looking at something completely different and it works better than anything we've ever seen.
Let me try to play devil's advocate. Could you argue that with Luka, the way it's set up, you don't really need any ball handling and playmaking, and you just have guys shoot and set screen like Dwight Powell or Davis Bertans, like just throw those guys out there. They don't need to shoot. They don't need to pass. That maybe that's all you need. Do you buy that argument? As I say it, I think like, well, it's really helpful for Dallas to be able to attack closeouts and make extra passes. So the second you get to that level of skill with the ball, then you can start playing 2- and 3-man handoff game with Jokic in the middle of the court. And all you have to do is back cut or hit open threes, because that's what he's turned the game into for his teammates. You just back cut or hit open threes. You pick the way you'd like to slowly get tortured on defense.
That's exactly it. And I feel like every Mavericks game kind of, there's like this time where it's like, all right, this the defense is just going to start blitzing him. And at that point, like Luka just passes it off. He does that thing where he dribbles. And like you point out in the video, hits the behind the back pass immediately. And then the Mavericks just kind of ping pong the ball around until somebody gets an open shot. Whereas Jokic, it just looks different, like you said. Like, you don't even need the spacing. The Mavericks are still predicated on guys that can move the ball and can shoot open jump shots. And frankly, I think Jokic could have, like, one of the best offenses in the NBA without, a single shooter on the court besides him. I feel like he could pull off something like that. Maybe that's a little hot, but I feel like it would work.
Okay, what if I told you that this season, without Spencer Dinwiddie, Jalen Brunson has been moved to New York. Jalen Brunson, by the way, a nice little Lone Star guy himself. He's off to New York. Luka Doncic, 41 points per 75, plus 7% true shooting, 23 box creation, creating 23 shots for his teammates per 100, has a near-perfect passer rating, is shooting 38%, and Dallas's offensive rating is 123 in those 500-something minutes. Is that good enough to get it done?
It's incredible. He's an incredible Helio guy, but with Jokic, it's just like its own animal. It's its own thing that I don't know what to do with, and no one knows what to do with, so I'm like, I don't know, I guess this is just the best. Do you find that convincing? Is that a cop-out?
No, I mean, I find it convincing because the Nuggets have played. I mean, if you were to counter me, if you were to say, Ben, these are all small sample stats, they're all a little noisy, there's nothing we can do to them. But I see what you just said about Luka. I see hitting the 40-point club, which has almost never been done in the history of when we have this data. James Harden did it a couple times when he was going crazy in Houston. Maybe Steph Curry touched it. Just three or four people maybe have ever done it. Plus, Luka has the efficiency, the offensive rating. Fantastic. Great job. Nikola Jokic this year, when Bones Highland and Jamal Murray are on the bench, he's 21% ahead of the league in true shooting. His true shooting is 78%. His true shooting is 78%. Okay. Let me say this again.
Okay.
When Bones Highland and Jamal when Bones Highland and Jamal Murray are on the bench, the Nuggets offensive rating is 128. So yeah, I really don't know. I just know that one of these guys is number one. How about that?
Yeah.
How about that? One of these guys, these are the top two guys. Is that acceptable?
A small nugget that just made me, funny nugget. A small nugget that made me really think about this is, I don't know if you saw, but I think it was Dave Adelman took over as head coach for the Nuggets last night. Dave Adelman, son of Rick Adelman, one of our favorite coaches of all time. And I was like, what does Rick Adelman think? Like, is he ever at home like, oh, if I had Jokic on my team, I would pay so much money to see a Rick Adelman offense with Jokic at the helm.
Wow. That would be absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
You just broke my brain, Cody. You just broke my brain.
That's what I'm saying. So I'm glad Dave got the win last night as the spiritual, the son of the famous Rick Adelman.
If you're wondering what happens when Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. are on the bench, the Nuggets, this is a serious data point. In 241 minutes, the Nuggets are only outscoring teams by 7 points per 100. And that offensive rating, Cody, drops all the way down to 122.
Who's on the bench?
Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. They have a 122 offensive rating with those two guys on the bench. This show is drunk. If you want to support this podcast and anything else, Thinking Basketball, check out patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. I don't even know how to do the outro anymore. That's it. We have to end the episode. This new camera has been too much for me to take. I need to go gather myself and collect my wits. Cody, do you have any final thoughts before we get out of here?
No. Oh, blurry dog in the background. Blurry dog. That's my final thought.
The dog is blurry in this camera. That's it. Hope you enjoyed this one as always. And of course, that you are having a great day.